You're listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information, visit abc.net.au/conversations. Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. Here on Conversations, on some days we'll try and bring you stories of the little bits and pieces of everyday life. And other days we'll ask people to do nothing less than explain the very fabric of the cosmos. Well, this is one of those days. Stay with me for this hour because you'll find out what is our best guess now for how all this, everything in the world of space, came to be. It's the kind of thing you probably thought about a lot when you were a kid, but you eventually got distracted by mortgages and email and reverse parking and things like that. Well, Marcella Gleiser is here to get you thinking about the big stuff again. Marcella Gleiser is a professor of physics, astronomy and natural philosophy at Dartmouth College in the United States. And what he's really interested in is the very beginning, the moment when our universe erupted out of what he calls a small patch of weirdness. Marcella says that throughout human history, we've always been looking for an elegant, beautiful universe. It's only natural. Humans love beautiful, elegant things. Even today, scientists are looking for a grand, unified theory that can explain how the whole thing works. All we need is just a few more pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, and then the whole picture will be revealed. But they haven't found it. And Marcella says there's a very good reason why. It's because there is no grand plan, no cosmic blueprints. The universe is as imperfect and lopsided and clunky as you and me, and yet it's those imperfections that make it so dynamic and, dare I say it, lovable. Marcella Gleiser's book is called Imperfect Creation. Marcella, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
One of the things I like about your book is that you say this quest for perfection is a kind of a sterile thing. In painting, you can have a perfect reproduction of a portrait, if you like, of someone. But it's the bad brushstroke, they say, that makes it art, that gives it character, that brings it to life. You say this is a bit like Marilyn Monroe. What's your Marilyn Monroe analogy here?
So if you remember, Marilyn Monroe had a mole, or maybe you want to say a beauty mark. In fact, there's a scientific study. When does a beauty mark become a mole, right?
Because, when Marilyn Monroe's got it.
You know, because it gets bigger, eventually it gets ugly, right? So, but there is a touch there because that is a beauty mark, as you say. However, think of it this way. If you take it out, would that make Marilyn Monroe more or less beautiful?
Less beautiful.
And if you, now let's go really to the crux of the matter. What if you had a perfectly symmetric Marilyn Monroe with two exactly equidistant moles from in her face, on both sides of the face?
Less beautiful, again.
Well, hideous, right?
Yeah.
So symmetry, perfection, is not always a mark of beauty. And I think one of the messages that I want to bring forward with this book is that perhaps physics is a little old-fashioned in the sense that it is trying to insist in a pursuit of perfection and a pursuit of symmetry, which is not there. And in fact, as you mentioned, art sort of got rid of this 200 years ago, where, you know, instead of the reproductions which are perfect, you start having these sort of expressionism and surrealism and impressionism, where you're really trying to change the way we picture reality and make it more beautiful because it's imperfect. And I think science is insisting a little bit on a very old paradigm that nature has to be perfect and because of that it's beautiful. And I'm saying, no, you know what? Nature is not perfect and because of that it's beautiful.
I really enjoyed reading that you think that this search for a unified theory of everything, the grand unified theory, is really a boneheaded mistake. I was always kind of irritated when, I think it was the 1980s, people like Stephen Hawking and other physicists and cosmologists were saying, ladies and gentlemen, we are on the verge of a theory of everything. We'll be able to explain the mechanics of everything in the whole universe. That was never going to happen, I would have thought. The world isn't like that. It just didn't seem to feel right to me.
Isn't it pretentious?
It is. Yeah.
To think that we can do that. So, and there are so many reasons why we can't, right? So let me give you a technical reason why you can't do that, right? Very simple. If you think about how it is that we do science, right? Science is an empirical, especially the physical sciences, is empirical, meaning we look at the world, we measure the world with our tools, and then we come up with theories to explain what it is that we're seeing. So be it a telescope, a microscope, or more sophisticated machines, that's what we do in order to create meaning, right? Now, the point is this, is that every machine that exists has a limit. It can only see so far. You know, you think of a telescope like Galileo's telescope, 1609, he's looking at something. Well, you know, a binoculars nowadays is much more powerful than that. And so what a tool can see is only limited, which basically tells you that the amount of information we have of reality is never complete. There's always stuff out there that we just cannot get to, which then tells you the following, like, how can you know that you have a theory of everything, a final theory, if you don't know everything there is out there? You just can't. Because you say, aha, here, I woke up Tuesday, got this brilliant idea, got my final theory, and then on Friday, some guy will say, but wait, I just measured a new phenomenon that doesn't fit your theory. So you just can't do it.
So what you're saying is then that the universe, the world, the universe, is a place of infinite complexity then? Is that what you mean by that? Like there's no end to how complex, how small and how big and how detailed and how much detail there is in the world.
So we don't know if it's infinite is a very heavy word, you know, but you can say that it's certainly a world that has so much complexity that it's kind of...
there's no end in sight. How about
fruitless
that?
For us to kind of say that, yes, that we'll actually one day comprehend the whole of it. Because there's always going to be something else to comprehend.
Now, you put your finger on a kind of an instinct that humans have had for, well, ever since we've had science, really, ever since we've had science and religion, which is to look for this one explanation, whether it's been God or even scientists even today looking for this grand unified theory. And it goes right back to a guy called Thales in ancient Greece. Now, he came out and said, everything comes from water. Right. And he was wrong.
First philosopher came up with the wrong idea. But the point is what he was trying to do, and that's exactly right, so I'm glad you brought this up, is that he was trying to come up with a single explanation for all that exists. This idea of unifying, that everything is one, is really not just province of philosophy, it's very much a religious idea, right? And if you go and you think of the Judeo-Christian tradition, there is the God, right? He is one. Everything comes from God and everything goes back to God. So there is this idea that oneness is the way we should go for. And indeed, you know, you start with Thales and all the other pre-Socratic philosophers that followed him, always searching from this oneness, this idea that there is absolute reality out there, there is something absolute and concrete and unique about the world. And this notion gets mixed up with religion in the Renaissance. And you have people like Newton and Galileo and others and Kepler saying that, yes, the world is the creation of a geometer God, a designer that knew a lot about mathematics. And because God is perfect, the world that is created by God has to be perfect as well. And what is more perfect? Symmetric stuff. So symmetry has to be engraved in the very fabric of the cosmos, right? And this pursuit for this symmetry underlying everything that exists remains alive today.
So it begins as an artistic idea and becomes a mathematical idea and a religious idea. And we've still got it today, even from physicists and cosmologists who are sworn atheists. They're still held in this idea that the universe is ultimately one thing.
Yes.
Even though you'd think there couldn't be anything more different than today's physicists and religious people, but this is what they have in common.
Which is sort of a provocative aspect of my argument, saying, you know, you thought that religion and science were separate, but here we are, you know, with some of the leading physicists in the world saying that we're looking for oneness. You are looking for this single theory that explains everything.
Now, given that you've lumped in these physicists with creationists, is it difficult to you when you go to conferences? Do you get shunned? Are you a controversial figure?
I think I'm going to become more and more. You know, my book just came out in April in the United States and May here in Australia. So it's kind of a recent thing. But, you know, the point is that people should remember something really important, which is the following, is that the vast majority of physicists couldn't care less about unification and all that. They are doing their work in their laboratories. They are working with material science. They're creating the chips. They're going to become the new fast machines. They are looking at how stars are blowing up and stuff like that. So it's really a minority of visionaries, if you want, that, and I myself, I have to say, I'm included in that minority, that are interested in these very fundamental questions that get a lot of press. Why do they get a lot of press? Because they touch on some very fundamental questions, you know, such as the origin of everything and the origin of the universe and the origin of life. And people are very fascinated with that. So people think, so there's this huge number of guys out there looking for this theory of everything. And it's really just a few thousand.
My guest in conversation is Marcelo Gleiser. He's a major league professor of physics, astronomy, and natural philosophy in the United States at Dartmouth College. And he's written a book called Imperfect Creation, Cosmos, Life, and Nature's Hidden Code, where he says a lot of people who are looking at the big picture are looking for this grand unified theory or a theory of everything or God's blueprint for in science, in the mechanics of the cosmos. It's a fruitless search. You're not going to find it, except the universe is imperfect, just like we are. You give all sorts of evidence in your book that the universe isn't symmetrical. It's asymmetrical. There's way more matter than there is antimatter. There's, I think, neutrinos that turn left rather than right. There's the evidence is overwhelming that the universe is lopsided all over the place. It's sloppy. It's messy. And yet beautiful. Beautiful for all that. Beautiful for all its messiness, Marcelo.
Yes. I think that it's time for us to develop a new aesthetic, you know, of nature. And instead of looking at, like John Keats, you know, beauty is truth and truth beauty, I would say that, yes, but what beauty is that? Well, it's the beauty of the asymmetric, the imperfect, all the imbalance that exists in the universe. So you talk about neutrinos, for example, and you talk about the excess of matter over antimatter, which is something that shouldn't be existing according to the laws of particle physics. But without that imbalance, we wouldn't be here. And even more, the imbalance of life. Life is full of asymmetries, several of them. And just to bring one quickly out is mutations. You know, without failures, errors in the genetic reproductive process, we wouldn't be here. Life would be inviable. So the only reason life is viable is because it's not perfect. And to me, that's a very important lesson that we have to bring to heart.
Now, Marcelo, let's talk about you for a moment. You grew up in Brazil. When we're talking about Brazil, I mean, most Australians will think, is it Rio? And is it Rio, indeed?
Yeah, it is Rio.
It is.
Yes. Yeah, I grew up a block away from Copacabana Beach. So, and I used to go to Ipanema Beach every weekend to play volleyball at the beach. So very much a beach kind of guy.
You surfy?
I tried. It never quite worked. I was not very good at surfing. I really tried. But I was pretty good at volleyball. I was Brazilian champion in volleyball when I was 16. So that worked. But then I stopped growing and I quit volleyball. Well, I didn't quit, but I wasn't as competitive anymore. And I started to take science a little more seriously.
You write in your book, you were a spooky kid for a while. You were interested in vampires and that aspect of pop culture. What do you think sparked your interest in that?
Well, you see, at that time, vampires were not part of pop culture. I was way ahead of the time, right? I mean,
this
I'm talking
before Twilight, before
way before Twilight. So
Anne
I'm
Rice,
talking, I'm talking the 70s here. I was fascinated with vampires, in particular Dracula. And so it was really about all the different versions of Dracula. And you probably, if you're here in Australia, familiar with Christopher Lee and all those
Hammer horror films. Yeah.
Hammer horror, exactly. Mm. I used to watch all of them. I was completely obsessed with all of that stuff. And you know, the reason being sort of sad, actually very sad, is that I lost my mother when I was a little boy, when I was six, in somewhat tragic circumstances. And so death kind of knocked at my door much before it should. And so I was very fascinated in a sort of morbid way with some way of transcending life. No? And the attempt there, of course, was, well, maybe if I were a vampire, you know, I was half dead and I was half alive, then I could actually be in touch with my mom. Now I know. Of course, when I was a kid, I did not know any of that. It was just happening. But it was really an attempt to find a way of being closer to her. And this went on until, of course, at 13 or so, I realized that was not going to work, that I was not a vampire, and that perhaps the best way to deal with loss was by holding on to life.
Was religion attractive to you for a while?
It was. I was, I grew up in a Jewish family, and so I went to Jewish schools, and we learned all about the Old Testament. And, of course, that doesn't help very much your fantasy because you're talking about angels wrestling with people and God doing all sorts of things. So if you really take those ideas seriously, you know, your grip on reality is kind of flaky. And to me, you know, if the Bible was saying that these things were happening, why not a vampire? What's the difference between an angel and a vampire? It's just an angel of death kind of thing. Until, of course, I started to learn history. And when you start to learn history and you hear what religions have done through the centuries, then, at least in my case, I became less interested in religion. In fact, I was shocked by how many killings and murders have been perpetrated in the name of a god, be it, you know, whatever god is. And I grew up to be horrified with all of that. And then I was in a quandary because I said, okay, it's not religion. How am I going to find my answers? And that's where I discovered science. And I realized that science was not just about little balls hitting other balls and electric currents running around wires, but it was actually dealing with some very, very fundamental questions of existence. And I just never stopped wanting to be a scientist ever since.
Did you survive the high school period where they try and knock all your curiosity in that kind of larger world out of you?
Yes, that's a very good point. It is a miracle, isn't it, that some of us actually survive all of that and do become scientists, because a lot of the teaching is so boring and so not interesting that you've got to wonder. But something interesting happened in my life, though. And Einstein came to Brazil in 1925. And because my grandfather was a big shot in the Jewish community, he was his host. So my grandfather hosted Einstein in Rio in 1925, and they took a picture together. And when I was 13, because I was already saying, I like science and stuff, I got this picture as a gift, and it was autographed by Einstein and by my grandfather, you know, they're side by side like this, and I was just blown away. Right. And so I created a little altar. So instead of vampires, I started to actually like Einstein, which is a much more constructive period of my life. And I started to want to learn more about this man and his ideas. And, you know, and I realized that Einstein was in many ways not just the hardcore scientist, but he was a bohemian. He loved women.
He's a lovely man.
Yeah, he wasn't a good father, but he was a good, you know, he was a good guy in that sense of enjoying life as well. And more than that, he was fascinated with the mysterious. And to me, you know, an impressionable teenager, to hear that the greatest scientist, you know, of the 20th century, one of the greatest of all time, was interested in the mysterious and would say that that is what really propelled him to understand the world was just wonderful.
There is so much of the mysterious. That's why I like this stuff. I'm fascinated with it. I'm not a scientist. I never had that education. I had that knocked out of me in high school. But there's a kind of a veil drawn across what we can even comprehend mm-hmm. when we talk about these things. What was there before the Big Bang, if indeed the Big Bang did occur? How did something come out of nothing? Is space a something or a nothing? All these things that are very hard. And how far can the universe extend when we understand the universe to be absolutely everything? All these, I'm not asking you to answer these questions because we simply don't know. Einstein also used to say things like, God doesn't play dice
right.
with the universe. And I think he was talking about quantum physics there, wasn't he? What do you think he meant by God when he said that? Did he believe in a God?
No, not at all. He was very clear about that. He did not believe in God, in particular the God of the Old Testament. You know, he thought it was ridiculous to think that a God would be worried about each person's destiny and things like that.
What about a non-religious God, if you like, a non-specific God, a God as the great architect, if you like, of
well,
the universe?
Well, so when he was pressed, he would say that his God was like Spinoza's God, you know, this Jewish philosopher from the 17th century, where basically the notion was that God was everywhere. There was no personified God at all, but it was just the notion that there was an order to the universe, there was an order to nature, and it was manifest everywhere. And science was one bridge to get into that order. You know, he was a unifier, by the way. He spent the last 20 years of his life searching for a unified theory that would put together two of the four forces of nature, gravity and electromagnetism, and he failed. But the point is that he believed in this unity, and I think that to him that was God in a metaphorical way.
You take a look back at some of the great thinkers, and the, you know, there's Galileo and Kepler. Kepler is this amazing guy. He comes across some beautiful theories. He figures out that the reason why the planets move is due to the interaction between them. Really, that's what drives their mechanics. But then he comes up with a really crazy idea, a beautiful, crazy, false idea. How did he think the distance between the planets worked?
I love Kepler. He is, to me, by far my favorite character in the whole history of science.
Why?
Because not just he was a genius, you know, there are others like that, but he was an amazing human being. He spent many years trying to figure out the shape of the orbits, of the planetary orbits around the sun. For 3,000 years, since the beginning of astronomy, people believed that the orbits were circles. And Kepler had the best data at the time that he wrestled from a guy called Tycho Brahe, who was this maniac, wild astronomer prince from Denmark, who was always drunk and who didn't have a nose because his nose was sliced off in a duel.
He had a silver nose, didn't he?
Yeah,
did he have
yeah.
a silver one he put on?
He had a silver nose.
Yeah.
And he was this big, big guy with bright red hair and beady eyes and this big silver nose. And he was really scary. He even had a dungeon in his castle where he would torture the people that didn't pay taxes on his property.
Yeah, see, that's my hero right there, I think. But anyway, I didn't mean to...
So Tycho was the best astronomer at the time. He has the greatest data. And Kepler spends 18 months as his assistant. And Kepler was the opposite. He was the Woody Allen of science, you know, neurotic, frantic, insecure, very, very kind of, aggressive too in his own neurotic. So these two, they just clash head on, right? But Tycho had the data. Kepler had the ideas. Eventually, Tycho dies because he basically drinks too much and his bladder explodes. And he dies. And then Kepler gets his data. So look at this story, right? This is an amazing story. Kepler gets the data, and he's like this plebeian that ends up becoming the imperial mathematician to Rudolf II, who was the Holy Roman Emperor in Prague in the early 1600s. You know, that's the same time Galileo is pointing his telescope in Italy, right? Then, of course, he's always broke. They never pay his salary. He is a Lutheran astronomer in a Catholic court, and he's always being kicked out from place to place. So he's the kind of the errand astronomer, and he has a real miserable life. And yet, he's looked for order in the skies. So what does he do? He says, you know, nobody has ever figured out why there are only six planets. So you have to remember, this is early 1600s. People didn't know about Uranus and Neptune.
Yeah, so the solar system stops at Saturn.
Right.
Yes.
And he also thought that God was a geometer. And he said, if God is a geometer and he created the universe, he has to satisfy very simple geometrical rules. I have to figure them out. If I figure them out, then I'm understanding the mind of God. So what does he do? He's lecturing one day, and then he has this amazing insight. He says, wait a second. There are only five perfect solids in geometry, okay? And the listeners will remember two of them. A cube that has six squares as sides, so that's perfect. And a pyramid, which has four triangles, okay? So these are two of the five perfect solids. The others have more sides to it. But there are only five of them, and they are the most elegant figures you can construct. So Kepler thought, wait a second, there are only five of them. So let's play with these solids like those Russian dolls. They could put one inside the other, you know.
Well, so he nested them inside each other.
He nested them, right? And he says, okay, so the sun is in the center, first thing. Then you have a little sphere for Mercury because it's the first planet. Then you put a solid around it. Okay, and then you put a sphere around that first solid, and that sphere is for Venus, the second planet. And you go doing this, one inside the other, one inside the other, one inside the other, and if you use up your five solids, you can put six spheres. So that's why there are only six planets in the universe, because there are only six perfect geometrical figures, and God, being this wonderful geometer, had to use the most symmetric arrangement possible to build his cosmos.
So this is very real to him then. He's figured this out, and he thinks, I know what God was thinking when God made the universes, or probably thought that's as big as he thought it would be, didn't he?
Yeah.
So he thought, I have now figured out what God was thinking.
Yes.
God himself was thinking.
He flipped. He actually thought he was some kind of prophet, you know, that there was a revelation going on here. And listen to this one. If because the geometry is fixed in such a clear way, you can actually calculate the distances between the planets, right? Because where the spheres fit within these solids.
And does that work?
It works to within 5%.
That's not bad.
That is amazing, right? So he was...
Are you sure he wasn't right? Are you sure?
You know, it was a mind-blowing thing. And this dream, this kind of ecstatic revelation of his, you know, carried him on for the rest of his life. Even though it was wrong, even though he discovered elliptical orbits afterwards, he would say, well, you know, the spheres are thick. And so if the spheres are thick, you can find orbits which are not perfect circles in them. But that arrangement stayed with him forever.
And that thinking still continues today, you say, with the people who believe they can find a cosmic blueprint, a grand unified, a theory of everything. It's a delicious thought, isn't it, in a way? It's a kind of a thought. It's thrilling and reassuring at the same time.
Exactly.
It's all mapped out.
It's comfortable. You know, it's safe. And people like that, right? And so what happened, of course, with Kepler is that he didn't know there were just more than six planets. There was Uranus and Neptune too. If he had known about these two other planets, his scheme wouldn't work. So his blindness was his blessing.
Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and podcast.
Today, my guest in conversation is Marcelo Gleiser. He's Professor of Physics and Natural Philosophy and Astronomy at Dartmouth College in the United States. And his message, if there's anything in this book that he's written, is that scientists should stop looking for a oneness in the universe, a one great single explanation for how it all patches together, a theory of everything. I want you to explain nothing more than the birth of the universe to us now, Marcelo, our best picture. Now, that the picture we have of the birth of the universe that we live in, a lot of the thinking today says that there was a bubble of space and time that emerged from a sea of nothingness. The universe popped into existence like a bubble out of something or nothing. What? Explain what you mean.
Right. So let's go by parts. Let me tell you first what we do know. We know the following. We live in a big galaxy called the Milky Way. This galaxy has about 300 billion other stars like the sun, okay, which is a huge number, okay? You get a beach about, I don't know, 4 kilometers long and 2 meters wide, and you count the grains of sand in this sort of stretch of the beach. That's about the number of stars in the Milky Way.
Oh.
So it is a ridiculous, big, huge number. And you look at this, and then you say, okay, that's not the only galaxy out there. There are hundreds of billions of other galaxies too.
What, hundreds of billions of galaxies?
Yes.
Each with billions and billions
of stars.
Of stars.
Yes. So think of them as little islands in the ocean, you know. So you think of these galaxies as islands in the ocean. They all have these enormous amounts of stars. And what was discovered early in 1929 is that these galaxies are not static. They're not really like islands. They're actually moving apart from each other. And they're moving apart in such a way that the farther away they are from us, the faster they seem to be moving away, okay? And the guy who discovered that was a guy called Edwin Hubble, you know, an American astronomer. And the way we picture that is simple. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but it works. Think of a party balloon, okay, that you can blow so it can grow bigger and bigger. And you stick some coins to the balloon. Okay, and just glue the coins to the balloon, and you blow the balloon. And what's going to happen as the balloon grows? What do you see? Well, if you're sitting in one coin, right, you're going to look around, and you're going to see the other coins moving away from you, right? And if you're sitting in another coin, and you're going to say, "Hey, I'm the center of the universe. Check it out. Everybody's moving away from me." And if you're sitting on another coin, you're going to say, no, wait a second. I am the center because everybody's moving away from me. So what's going on is that on the surface of a sphere, no point is more important than any other point. So all these galaxies are moving away from each other. And yes, if you look at faraway galaxies, they do move faster with their distance, okay? This is the expansion of the universe. Now, I was careful to talk about the balloon because when people talk about the Big Bang, they have this idea of a bomb exploding.
I can't get past that. I'm trying to, but I can't get past the idea of something exploding out of a bomb like a, or a hand grenade.
It is not.
It's not.
Right? It is not. And that's very common. And what's the confusion? Well, a bomb explodes, you know, and stuff, shrapnel, life flies off, right? But space is fixed. So this is all happening in fixed space. The universe is not, galaxies are not shrapnel of a bomb. They actually are being carried away by space itself.
So, what do you mean by that? Space? How can space is nothing? How can nothing be carrying it away?
Space is not nothing. Think of the balloon again, okay? And think of the coins on the balloon, right? They're not moving, but the balloon is growing. The space that, you know, these
galaxies, space between them.
Yes, is growing. And it's carrying them away just like corks floating on a river. So the expansion of the universe is not that stuff is floating away. It's that space itself is stretchy, just like a rubber band. And that's what's going on.
What's stretching? What is it that's stretching? Is it something? is it what? What is it? Is it this, just the space between, the emptiness between them?
It's the emptiness between them, yes. And remember, you know, that science is a representation of reality. This is very important, you know. So you cannot get too hung over on what is space, what's going on. So what we do is we know how to explain things. And so if you picture space as being stretchy, rubbery like this, then the theories that we apply to describe this expansion work really well to describe the data that we measure. And that's really the goal of science, you know, is to make sense of the measurement. So when that guy, you know, in 1929, pointed the telescope, Hubble pointed the telescope and saw the galaxies moving away, how can you explain that? Einstein's theory of relativity says that mass deforms space, and hence maybe the deformation of this geometry comes from the role of mass. And so the Big Bang is really this expansion of the universe. Now,
so we know that's happened.
We know that's happening.
Because one, everyone's running away from us. And the further away, the faster they're running from us. That's
we
one
know
thing.
That. We can measure that.
And the microwaves in the out in the cosmos is another reason why we think that's happening.
Right.
So we know that there was some kind of Big Bang of a kind then. I don't really know what to call it other than that. But what's our best guess for what happened at moment zero?
Okay, so
moment
let's get there.
Zero.
All right, so things are stretching. So now let's play the movie backwards.
Okay.
Right? So we're playing the movie backwards now. So what happens? Well, the balloon is deflating now, right? The galaxies are coming together. And there's going to be a point in time where everything's going to be on top of one another, right? The big, big mess, right? That moment in time is the beginning of time, so to speak, right? That marks when the point where matter was at its maximum point of compression, if you want.
Compressed into what? Into
right.
into a basketball or,
right.
or
I'm... Well, you have to be careful because, okay, so when we talk about how old the universe is, right, we're talking about the time it takes from the present time where we see the galaxies moving away from each other to the point in time, if you go backwards, where things were very close to each other. Now, you can't get back to time equals zero with known science. So when you say what was happening before the Big Bang, so that's where we have to draw the line between what we know and what we don't know. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is that if you keep going backwards in time and you try to use Einstein's theory of relativity that tells about the stretchiness of space, okay, to the very early moments, what's going to happen is that you're going to reach a point where the universe is going to be the size of an atom, or roughly the size of. So all the matter, you know, is going to be. Now, what does that mean? Well, you can't think of matter in terms of us anymore, or even in terms of atoms, you know, because as you start compressing things, the temperature shoots up. And when the temperature is very high, you start breaking apart all the structures. Okay, so molecules break into atoms. Atoms, temperature goes up, break into electrons flying one direction, protons flying the other direction. You keep going backwards in time, even the protons break up into smaller particles called quarks. So as you go backwards in time, the universe is not made of galaxies anymore. It's just like this soup of particles, you know, zipping around, hitting each other, colliding, very hot, very small. Okay? And if you keep going backwards and backwards in time, then we reach a realm that we don't really know what's going on anymore because our theories break down.
Because there is no time or space.
If you really want to go, well, if you want to go all the way down to that, then you're going to reach a point where you have to, the universe is so small that you have to change the physics that you're using to describe things. So instead of the theory of relativity Einstein uses, you have to use quantum mechanics, which is the physics that describes atoms and the world of the very small. Problem is, when you try to apply the laws of quantum mechanics to space and time, all hell breaks loose.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
That's, but we've got to be fine with that for a while, don't we?
Yes.
We have to just accept that. That's hard, isn't it?
It's hard. But, you know, and what do we do? Well, theorists love not knowing because then you speculate, right? So we speculate and we say, okay, what can we say about the very early moments, you know, based on these sort of abstract notions of quantum theories? Well, what's the most fundamental, and I'm going to get to your soup exploding bubble soon. What is the most fundamental property of the world of the very small of atoms? Well, it turns out that the most fundamental thing there is that nothing sits still. An electron doesn't stay put in a spot in space. It's always vibrating, moving
jittery.
About, jittery, exactly. And so what does that tell you? That tells you that, well, energy, motion, the electron is jittery, right? It's a brrr, so it's not like us that we can sit still in a chair. The electron and all the particles are always vibrating. And now energy is related to motion. And if I put a piece of, I don't know, a bottle on a table and it's not moving, you can say, okay, that's a zero energy position. But because the electrons and the particles are always moving about, the energy is never zero. So according to the laws of quantum mechanics, you never reach a true zero energy situation. There is always a residual vibrational energy. Things are always jittering about, okay? So that's sort of a fundamental property of quantum mechanics, and a lot of our digital technology nowadays depends on all these properties.
So, sorry, is that the theory of oneness? I'm sorry, everything's jittery. I mean, everything is jittery, isn't it?
I mean, well, I don't know if that's a theory of oneness. You can say that everything is energy if you want, you know, and matter is energy. So in a sense, that's a oneness, but it doesn't really explain much. But yes, this jitterness is absolutely key because, okay, now you know the electrons do that. Now, if you go to Einstein's theory of relativity, it's a theory that describes space and time, the geometry of space. You know, you sit on a couch and you're behind the forms, the geometry of the couch. That is the matter, the form, and the geometry. So if you know the matter, you can calculate the deformation of the geometry. So Einstein, in a very Pythagorean sense, geometrized space and time. You know, time is related to space, so if you fool around with space, you fool around with time as well. Okay, so you bring this to the beginning of everything, and you say, well, if everything is jittery and space and time have to satisfy the laws of quantum mechanics, space and time are also jittery. So you can't really talk about a flat, nice piece of table anymore. It's fluctuating like crazy, going crazy like this. Time is not always going like a river in one direction. It goes forwards, it goes backwards. So quantum space-time is completely random and chaotic, okay? So if you go back in time and you reach that stage in the history of the universe, you're talking about a situation where there is no more a distance between two points is a meter or the interval between two events is a second because you just don't have those sticks to measure things anymore.
It just doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
To say that, to even think that way.
Exactly. And so when people say, what was happening before the Big Bang? Well, that theory doesn't make any sense. There is no time before the Big Bang because time is something that we use to refer to things that change, right? I mean, if nothing changes, there is no time, right? Time is about things changing. So when you get to these early moments where fluctuations are going crazy and there is no linear evolution of time, you can't really talk about time. Before.
Right, before or then and after, right.
So that is the answer. There is no before the Big Bang because you don't even have an era of time. However, okay, what you can think about, and this is really mind-blowing, and this is now, I have to tell to everybody, speculation, people, speculation, but really cool speculation, which is the following. Okay, so you look at these patches of space which are bubbling around. Think of like a soup, you know, bubbling around. And imagine now that this patch of space stretches through infinity. Okay, so you have space bubbling around through infinity. But, you know, some of these bubbles may grow and then go away. Others may blow and grow and grow and grow and grow and become a universe. So the way we picture things now, we call it the landscape, okay? And the lens or the multiverse is that our universe, the one we live in, happens to be a single bubble that out of this multiverse of possibilities happened to have the right properties to have expanded, survived, kept expanding, and it's old enough to create stars and structures and eventually people that can be asking these questions. In the multiverse, there can be all sorts of failed attempts at existence, you know, universe that just don't work. So ours happens to be one that works.
It's sometimes said that one of the wonders of the universe is that it's so favorable to life. I think that's called the anthropic principle, isn't it? That if it had been a little bit hotter, we couldn't have had stars or anything like that forming, or a little bit colder, we couldn't have anything either. And the fact that the events of the Big Bang unfolded the way they did seems to be, from our point of view, all about us, about making the universe possible for life. What do you say about that? What do you think about that?
I'm so glad you asked, because I mount a very strong attack against this idea of the anthropic principle. To me, it's a real tautology. If you think about it, you know, we say, "Oh, look, we're here," and you say, "We're here," and yes, the universe had to have certain properties in order for us to be here, such as it had to be old enough so that it could form stars. Stars had to have planets. Planets had to have water. And for that to happen, you have to have a certain chemistry. For stars to exist, you have to have a certain nuclear physics. You know, you have to have hydrogen and all sorts of things happening with certain properties. And they say, look at that. If the proton or the neutron was a little heavier, we wouldn't be here. So what? I mean, you know, it's going backwards here. You know, the fact that we are here is obvious. And yes, the universe had to have these properties. So in the book, I make an analogy, which is the following. Imagine a library, okay? And you are in this library, you're walking around this library. You've never been in there before. You walk around and you look at the books in the library, and they're all in English. And you say, huh, this library must have been done for me because I can speak English and these books are all for me. I can read them all. Am I not special because these books are all in English? But then, of course, next door, there's another library where all the books are in Chinese, and the person is going to be surprised, you know, this is the wrong library for me, right? So the point of the universe having these properties doesn't help at all in explaining why we're here. The debate that is going on right now with the anthropic principle, and I wrote a paper recently saying that there's nothing anthropic about the universe at all. You go and you look out there, and to say the universe is just right for life, well, take a look around. You know, you look at Venus and at Mars and Jupiter. Those are horrendous places. The universe is extremely hostile to life. Life is an aberration. It's almost like a miracle because it's so rare. And so it's actually not that the universe is cut off for life, but the argument that I develop in a lot of detail in the book is that it's quite the opposite, that life is extremely rare and more than that, multicellular complex life is even rarer, and intelligent life, we have no clue, you know. So instead of saying that the universe is just right for life, like the Goldilocks, you know, pudding, right? Like my friend Paul Davies wrote a book called The Goldilocks Dilemma, and I've already locked horns with him a little bit about this. I say, no, it's the other way around. The universe is very wrong for life, and the fact that life exists is a wonderful, wonderful accident. Because you see, people has this notion that, oh, if there is no purpose in the universe, then life is pointless. Why are we here if we are not created by some benevolent God, or if there isn't some sort of the universe is not plotting for us to be here? And I think, again, that these notions that the universe is just right for life is crypto-religion. Once again, is this idea that there is a purpose for us to be here. And I'm saying, no, no, forget that, and let's look at the facts. And you look at Earth, okay? Earth is an amazingly rare planet. Yes, there will be other planets like Earth, you know, but still, Earth is a very, very rare planet. And it had all these properties, or it has all these properties that sort of combine in order to create complex life here. Life has been on Earth for about 3.5 billion years. Earth is about 4.5 billion years, okay? So for 3.5 billion years, life has been here. Multicellular complex life has only been here for 500 million. So for 3 billion years, life was made of little amoebas, okay? It wasn't complex at all, right? And so there is no plan, once you have life, to develop complex life or to develop intelligent life. What exists is the best adapted species will survive. And so the fact that we're here and that so many things conspired for us to be here, example, the moon, right? Our moon, the fact that the Earth has a single moon and a very large moon is fundamental for our existence because the Earth is like an inclined top. You know, it's inclined by 23 degrees and it's spinning around. If the moon wasn't there, this inclination would vary with time. And if the top wobbles like this, the temperature, the seasons would go completely crazy. You know, the fact that we have four seasons is because we have this inclination. If the moon wasn't there to stabilize the Earth, there would be no seasons. Water could freeze for millions of years. And life, complex life, needs stability to exist. That's one example. There are several other examples of properties that a planet needs to have in order to have complex life. So I would say, you know, the only thing the anthropic principle is telling us is that there are certain conditions the universe needs to have in order to develop life. But that life, that the universe is right for life, I think that's a real long shot.
Marcelo Gleiser is here. He's a scientist, a professor at Dartmouth College in the United States. His book is called Imperfect Creation, Cosmos, Life, and Nature's Hidden Code. And yet, people listening to hear you say that will be going, oh, he's another physicist, another cosmologist, telling us yet again we're not special. But you think we are special?
Oh, yes. I think we are extremely special. It's exactly the other because, you know, if you look at the history of modern science, it's one humiliation after another, right? I mean, if you start before Copernicus, right, 1500, say, the Earth was the center, so there we are.
And it's all about us, yes.
It's all about us. We're created the image of God. We're the top, right? And then, of course, we're displaced, become a little planet, right? And but we still, you know, the sun is the center. It's our solar system. But then in 19th century, nope, we are not the center. There's a galaxy out there. The galaxy has billions of stars. So we're getting, and then there are billions of galaxies. The universe is expanding. So really, you know, the more we learn about the universe, the less important we become. And what I'm saying is that, no, what modern science is showing is precisely the opposite, is that because there are all these imperfections, all these accidents that conspired in a random way without any plan to create a complex life form in this planet, that makes us, the intelligent species on this planet, incredibly special because we are the ones that have the conscience to think about all of this, to understand the rarity of our planet, the rarity of life, and to do something about it. So I would say I actually call this human centrism, you know, instead of anthropocentrism, which was the old thing. Say human centrism, instead of humans go back to center stage as the guardians of life. Once we understand the importance and the rarity of all that. So, yeah, we are extremely important because there are no aliens out there. Or if they are, they haven't visited us, unfortunately. New, you know, the UFO stuff, sorry to say, it's a lot of hot air. And so we are alone for practical purposes. Maybe there is, I'm not excluding the possibility that there is life somewhere 2,000 light years away from us. Possible. But, you know, it hasn't been here. We don't know about it. And
if there can be life that can cross these interplanetary, interstellar distances, if you like, you'd have to conclude they'd have to be vast, immortal, and maybe invisible. And we would be like a pinprick to them, perhaps.
Yeah, they'll be like gods, right?
They'll be like gods, yeah.
So you can't really distinguish. Mm.
There's a moment in the movie Watchmen, which is made from a really brilliant graphic novel by Alan Moore. There's a character called Dr. Manhattan, who's a guy who's got godlike powers. Eventually, he's tired of Earth. He's tired of his girlfriend. He goes to live on Mars. And his girlfriend goes to have an argument with him. And she tries to sort of plead with him and make him understand why human beings are worthwhile saving. He says, well, what's so perfect? What's so special about humans? Because why are you any better or worse than this beautiful desert on Mars that I'm looking at right now? But then he changes his mind, and there's a scene in the movie, I'll play it for you now, where he describes why he changes his mind and he comes to the conclusion that one single person is unique.
Miracles. Events with astronomical odds of occurring, like oxygen turning into gold. I've longed to witness such an event, and yet I neglect that. In human coupling, millions upon millions of cells compete to create life. For generation after generation, until, finally, your mother loves a man. And out of that contradiction against unfathomable odds, it's you. Only you that emerged to distill so specific a form from all that chaos. It's like turning air into gold.
Now, aside from all the melodramatic acting from Billy Crudup there and the music as well, what do you think of that sentiment that out of one individual you could distill so highly a specific form? It makes each one of us miraculous.
I love it. You know, I mean, I take away the sort of religious aspects of the miracle and say that this is just the beautiful way the universe is. And I think what science brings to us is this spectacular spiritual vision of the universe and of our role in it. That is very fulfilling. You know, if I tell you that in your hand you have atoms that came from different stars that blew up 5 billion years ago, and you look at your hand and say, wow, so I'm really stardust, that you are stardust. And what's most beautiful about it is that you are animated stardust. And because of all these flukes, we actually are animated stardust that can contemplate existence and can make movies like Watchmen and can think about the early universe and the origin of time, and to me, nothing beats it.
Marcelo, fantastic to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
It's my pleasure, and I hope to be back one day.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.